Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. The title of today's show is, to use the podcast, only press the button once. That is from EJ on Twitter. Runner-up was Checo yourself before you Recco yourself. And that was from Agon Monk on Twitter as well. You know I'm going to have words to say about Perez today. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners. So let's be friends. Welcome to our Barcelona race review. This was actually a great race today. It had all the elements that I love in Formula One. Great wheel-to-wheel action, strategy, and just a sprinkling of drama as well. And I just was not expecting that from my Spanish Grand Prix when I woke up this morning. So coming up, we'll discuss what made the race so interesting. We'll discuss the Red Bull driver management and yet another dominant display from the Bulls. Ooh, we'll have to talk about the Tifosi nightmare. So sorry, Tifosi. And is this the light at the end of the Mercedes tunnel? And we'll explore some surprising successes in the midfield as well. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. I'm joined today for this race review by Chris Stevens. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Spanners. Filling in for Matt today, but you know, he's here with us in trumpet spirit.
Yes, but in another sense, he's not here at all. So let's not speak of his name. Only Chris Stevens matters and Kyle Power. Hello, Kyle.
Can every race be a multi-stop race, please?
Yeah, maybe the historic tracks need high tyre wear. Mm. We've also got Jonathan Simon. Hello, Jono.
Hello. I was a DNS from the last podcast, but I can confirm we have a reliable system for this one. So let's get it going. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's get on with the race review. Okay, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it was actually a decent race. I don't think this is harsh, Kyle, but I was not expecting a thriller. And actually, after Miami, which didn't quite bite, and knowing that we had the Monaco Grand Prix coming up after this, I was a bit down, actually. I was a bit despondent, like, oh, yeah, well, it's Barcelona. I appreciate Barcelona for what it is. But as an older fan of F1, I sort of feel a little bit of responsibility to the newer fans in a weird way. Like, I want to kind of apologise in advance. But this race, it kicked off. It had all the elements of a great F1 race.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because it was so hot and so many high-load corners that the tyres just couldn't go the distance. Now, I don't think it was anything to do with the compound as such. It was just purely the heat because the hard tires weren't really used. But yeah, I was the same, especially after Miami. It was a bit, yeah, it wasn't great. And then, oh, Barcelona. But if we remember back to last year, we had quite an intriguing strategy battle last year with the Mercedes flipping onto a three-stop strategy to try and overtake Verstappen. And the same sort of played out this time. So I think if it's scorching hot in Barcelona, we know now we're going to get a good race if the tyres aren't too durable.
And that's what we need. It's the opposite of Bernie's sprinkler idea of making all the tracks wet. Maybe when it comes to historic tracks, we need under-track heating.
Warm them up. That's what we need, Spanners. Yeah. You're actually, honestly, that is probably a better idea than the sprinklers. I'll tell you what, it's probably more viable as well. I have to say, for Barcelona standards, that was like the greatest Formula One race of all time, because we never get good races at this track.
No, exactly. And my expectations were really low, Chris, but this got me thinking, you know, I don't actually know what, Matt's not here, so we don't know what compound of tyres we were on, but obviously Pirelli have a selection of tyres that they can choose from, and they pick a range of three to be their hard, medium and soft. Do we know where they were on the range?
Yes, I know exactly which tyres were being used, because I'm not just filling in for Matt, I am becoming
good.
The mat.
Okay, so what? So obviously, F1 can pick from their harder range or from their softer range. Where
exactly
were we today?
So we were on the hardest tires available, the C1, C2, and C3 tires. And it's really weird, because you would think such a high load circuit like this one, with the temperatures we were seeing as well, that the hard tire would be a viable option, but it just wasn't. People were avoiding it like the plague. The fact that we had everyone except for Lewis Hamilton starting on the soft tire shows just how useless that tire was this weekend.
Yeah, and it's been a gripe of mine for quite a while. I always keep saying that Pirelli go too conservative with their compounds, and you can't really blame them this year with the different cars and a new era, but they play a bit too safe. But it just shows that they are way too conservative, because the hard tire, as you say, you would have thought would have been a dead cert, and it's just none of the teams can get it into the window or turn it on. So quite a few of them had a brand new set of hards going into the race, and they didn't even consider it. Like poor Mick Schumacher, for instance, they actually said, oh, well, we can't use the hard. They just instantly discounted even bothering to try.
But then did it make it better, because it forced them onto the soft tire and we got multiple stops out of it?
Maybe. Jono?
I'm surprised that, yeah, nobody used the hard, especially at such a high load circuit, as we mentioned. But the funny part about it is, if they did bring the softest compound available, I think the tires would almost burst. So Pirelli can't do that in a sense. They have to bring these hard tires here because they have to cope with the high loads. That third corner, the long right-hander, as you saw Verstappen try to get around George Russell for like 20 laps, the left side tires would burst, as we saw for those F1 fans who watched 12 years ago, to our recollection, Lewis Hamilton happened to him with three laps to go.
Yeah, and it is the reason we're talking about the front lefts is predominantly, I think, the turn three, isn't it? So you've got the first sharp right-hander, a subtle kink to the left, and then a really long right-hander up the hill. And we saw, there's a few different lines through there, but I think that's flat in an F1 car, but you're constantly loaded on that left-hand side. Kyle, then Chris.
Yeah, it's turn three, then immediately afterwards it's turn four, and these corners...
Wait, hang on.
Turn
three and then four.
Three and then
right,
four afterwards,
it.
Yes. four is one of those corners where you have to get the car rotated, and then you're basically accelerating, leaning on that front left all the way around the corner. And also later on in the lap, you've got turn nine, Campsa corner, which is a huge load through the front left tire. So yeah, it's a front left killer.
Actually, and something that will come into play when we talk about whose fault is this later, when we talk about the crash between Hamilton and Magnussen, is in that turn four. It's quite rare in that you set yourself up very, very early for the corner, and you're accelerating way before anything like an apex, and then you're pinning it and just trying to keep it off of the gravel on the outside. Chris?
Yeah, so it's all the outside tires. You know, when you are in a car and you go around a corner a little bit too quickly, you get thrown to the outside, of the car. So if you're going through a left hander, you get thrown to the right side of the car. And it's the same for the tires. The outside tire is the one that takes the most punishment. And because we've got so many high speed and crucially very long right handers, like three and four, is what puts that pressure on the front left tire. Plus the searing temperatures that we saw as well, 37 ambient, pushing 50 on the track as well. So those tires were really having a hard time of it.
It does create an imbalance, because all the fast sweeping corners are right-handers, which means there's a lot of stress on the left side tires, but it seems like all the slower corners are left-handers. And so that creates a huge imbalance left to right. And that's another challenge the teams face, despite the fact spanners. They do around 30,000 laps or so at this circuit every year, probably.
Yeah, yeah. But it was completely different conditions in the test to what they're facing now. Like you said, it was much, much hotter. But in the olden days, and I'm going back as far as 2013, the engineers would do things like just swap the tyres around left and right on a high load circuit like this. And then at Silverstone, we ended up having multiple tyre failures, and that put a stop to all of that. But I think that the last thing on, you know, why this race was good was because we had that tyre wear, even if it was just on one side in particular. But that did lead to some really interesting strategy approaches. So before we get into talking about the teams, and I think we'll kick off with Red Bull's race first, by far the most interesting, I think. What were the strategy options available to everyone, Chris? What did we think the teams were going to do before the start of the race?
So there were a lot of rumours about what was going to be the potential best strategy, ranging from one stop to three stop, which is pretty rare these days to hear such variety. And you know, we've gotten so used to it just being wait for the safety car, make your pit stop. I know you're going to bring this up later, man. It's been a long time since we've gone through a whole race without a safety car.
Yeah.
And that probably didn't help matters. But yeah, the fact that we did get most of the top guys, all of the top guys were on a three stopper, but they were going about it in different ways about when they were going to stop and which tyres they were going to run in a crucial order as well. And when you consider that Charles Leclerc was the only one of those front runners with a new soft tyre available, which he used at the start of the race, I loved the fact that we just had such strategic variety in this one.
I'm glad you mentioned no safety car. There have been 35 consecutive races with at least two safety cars, yet the minute that Lewis Hamilton needs one, there wasn't. Suspicious, Kyle? No, Kyle, don't answer that. Make your serious point that you were going to make.
I was about to say, that's the beauty of multi-stop races. When you have more than one stop, you then open up several other options. So you get some people trying to go long on the first stint, other people doing a very short second stint. But once you've got the first stops out of the way, and we've seen this, we saw this throughout this race and last year at the same race, whereas it gives the person behind essentially the option to dive into the pits and have a ridiculously short second stint and then try and hang it out for the third stint. Whereas if it's just a one-stop race, you essentially only have one chance. But this one, you have several chances to play your cards. It's almost like poker when the blinds go in and you get a different little round of betting at each pit stops and who's going to bluff and who's going to show their cards or their hand first. So it's fantastic. And I'd really like to see more of these races, but it's a tough job for Pirelli to get the compounds right for it.
No, they've got it right once. My expectations could not be higher. So if you're right, if you're listening, Pirelli, you've got this exactly right this weekend. The balance between a two-stop and a three-stop, I think, is absolutely perfect for F1 racing, especially on a historic track. Don't worry, I won't judge you at Monaco. Monaco's not your fault. But where do we go after that? Montreal? Montreal after that? Yeah,
well, I think so, right.
And Baku, Montreal.
And then Baku. Okay, so from Montreal and Baku, no pressure, but get it exactly right, like you just did here, and we're absolutely golden. Understand that they do face an impossible task.
Well, Canada was the race that inspired the Heidegg Pirelli era, so maybe that will throw up something.
Yeah, that was like a five-stopper. Okay, Pirelli, I know you're listening, so I'll just say, don't do that again. I don't know. I think we could do the odd five-stopper. That's not going to hurt anyone. But let's go on to our review of the teams, and let's start with Red Bull. Now, I said last week, or last race review probably, that Red Bull are the team to beat in so many ways. They are honed, they have come into this season with a good race car, and bar some reliability issues, which is no small matter, and they reared their head a little bit again today. Aside from some of those maybe manufacturing issues, they are the team that is slickest. They are the team with the drivers that are honed, fresh from a championship battle, a team whose drills are slick, and they're just getting everything right. And Ferrari needed to step up their game to keep up with them. I think what we saw in this race, though, Kyle, was a scruffy race from Verstappen and from Red Bull. And Perez's race didn't go how we wanted it to go as well. And they were still able to pull through. So to me, Red Bull are looking like a frightening outfit this season.
Certainly, they're looking formidable. And as you say, it was quite a scruffy opening to the race with them, with Verstappen's mistake, but also on the strategy side, when Verstappen was tucked up behind Russell, he pitted directly behind Russell on the same lap, essentially locking himself in to behind. And they knew they had DRS issues. So I found that really, really surprising that they, that was almost like a ball drop on the strategy from Red Bull. But then they did very much repair that later with an extremely aggressive strategy and putting Verstappen on those soft tyres for the middle stint, which was electric.
Maybe underestimating Mercedes and Russell a little bit, thinking, oh, we can get past this guy, no problem. We've got, you know, we've been the kings of the straights all season long, and we've got a much faster car than the Mercedes, so we should get through it pretty quickly. Little did they know that George Russell proved today why he is in that car and not Valtteri Bottas.
Well, don't worry. We'll have our tingles about Russell in a little bit. Let's focus on Verstappen, who I think has probably had a flawless start to the season from a driver point of view. And actually, what we've not seen from Verstappen is just dropping it, is just mistakes. You know, we haven't seen like the Vettel 2017, 2018 losing the rears, cracking under pressure. So today, to see him suddenly spin off at turn four, Chris, that was a surprise. It was genuinely, as soon as we saw a Red Bull go off, I assumed it must be Perez. I was surprised that it was Verstappen.
Yeah, I was in the same boat thinking it must be Perez because Max Verstappen just, he doesn't make mistakes, you know.
Not those kind, for sure.
No, exactly. And it's so bizarre. And it seems like the same thing that caught Carlos Sainz out too, which was just this mad gust of wind, a tailwind going into turn four. So we talked about the headwind coming down the front straight, which makes it, you know, it's great for racing because the slipstream is more powerful and it's a bit easier to overtake. But when you're suddenly coming back the other way on the way into turn four, the wind is now behind you, and that's like pushing the car along and actually taking away your downforce, which suddenly makes it quite easy to drop the car. So it's a little bit of wrong place, wrong time there, because we all know how sensitive a Formula One car, any, you know, aerodynamic single seater is to the wind.
I will just say there was the Austrian Grand Prix, I think, in 2016, where Rosberg used the wind as an excuse and he was roundly mocked. Kyle, you're going to correct me.
Yeah, it was the 2015 USA Grand Prix. That's when he lost the championship.
How are you correcting me so quickly on that? That is absolutely amazing. I love this panel. But yeah, he was roundly mocked for that. But I think Carlos Sainz probably makes the case that there was a particularly, you know, tricky issue there. And the way he described it, he said, well, I just don't know what happened. And that would seem synonymous with like a wind spin condition. But sorry, Carl, I've interrupted you. Carry on your point. And then Jono.
I was about to say, yeah, it was so rare. I was shocked when it was Verstappen that had done it, because he has been largely flawless. You very rarely see a driving mistake from him. And the last one I can sort of remember is turn one at the French Grand Prix last year when he went wide. He recovered and still won the race, but he actually went off at turn one. But we just don't see these mistakes. And again, with Sainz, they're almost identical. Sainz ended up doing a full pirouette. Verstappen caught it up, but it just shows how on edge they are and how on edge they are with the setup. And we can maybe talk about it later, but Otto referenced that Sainz can't drive with such an aggressive setup as Leclerc can. So that's where the speed is coming from. So it just shows the fine margins and the absolute limit that they are on, that a sudden gust of wind can cause them to go off the track.
You know, I'm going to clip out, Carl. Sorry. Sorry, Jono, you carry on.
No, I was going to say that's a great point, because a lot of the great drivers you hear can drive a car on edge. And the fact that Sainz is struggling compared to, let's say, his teammate Leclerc, the fact that all of Verstappen's teammates until Perez jumped on board, and even Perez sometimes struggled with the car. Hamilton's been able to drive a pointy car. So even today, Verstappen showed a great example of him actually saving that. I know he went off the track, but he didn't pirouette and spin. And he's had a lot of moments where he just saved the car from a huge calamity and a huge spin and crash into the wall that not many other drivers on the grid can do.
Yeah, and this is also, like, you know, moving on from that, obviously that then puts him behind the Russell Perez battle. So Perez wasn't able to make a move. Some absolutely fantastic defending from Russell, but this is where Red Bull play a good team game. If you're a Verstappen fan, a frustrating and unjust team game if you're a Perez fan. But nonetheless, this is how Red Bull operate. Verstappen gets let through by Perez to then have a go at George Russell. And I think this brings us to probably one of the best battles of the race. So I think, you know, this is, I know we're talking Red Bull, but Russell really made himself a feature of the Red Bull race with his defending. And so Verstappen fights for his opportunity to get past, has an intermittent DRS issue, and also can't get past Chris. But it was you're right. It wasn't something they were going to expect to struggle with, even at Barcelona.
Yeah, and especially in the past, you know, you come up to the second Mercedes car and you can normally find a way pretty quickly, at least Verstappen could in years gone by. And yeah, it was not the case today. And yeah, I've got to say, I understand Max's frustration on the radio about the DRS issue, because especially when you consider that it was the same issue that they had at the very end of qualifying. It ruined his last run in Q3, potentially cost him pole position as well. And then suddenly to have this issue occurring in the race as well, very, very frustrating. But I would like someone to remind him that shouting like that on the radio and getting super frustrated about it isn't going to solve anything and is not going to lead anyone in the right direction. But I understand his frustration.
Look, the problem with that is I have no issues with him doing that because, I'm going to defend pro athletes all the time with this because nobody in the world can experience what they're going through. And, you know, I've had some experience in the pro sports scene. I've had some experience on both sides of it, whether it's coaching, playing, whatever. Now, on that note, what the problem with him and what Chris is saying is he's got to understand that this is being broadcasted. So where these athletes don't understand is that they think they're correct. But from a media perspective and from a fan perspective, we're not going to understand what they're going through. And they need to better manage that.
Yo, look, I've always hated it in Olympics when they throw the mic in front of a runner after he or she's been like doing 110 meter hurdles, and then suddenly they're huffing and puffing and suddenly they've got to answer an interview. So in that respect, you're right, and it is unfair to the athletes in a lot of ways. And we've certainly talked about it here. You know, maybe do we need a more curated view of the driver radio? On the other hand, it gives us as fans a sneak peek. We haven't chosen to have that sneak peek, but we get it. And so we do have a peek into driver mentality and psychology. And we had a really interesting chat with former Mercedes and Haas strategist, Mike Caulfield, on the show a couple of shows back, and he was saying, you know, it does have an effect on the team and the engineers when the drivers are being, you know, aggressive and difficult, because sometimes the strategists will have to look after themselves and will have to go in with themselves, and we don't know the power dynamics within various teams. We don't know if the strategists, are they completely free to overrule a driver, or will they have to, you know, answer to that, to Helmut Marko or to the Mercedes board? We just don't know. So earlier, I just tweeted, and I got a fair reaction from this. I just said, you can say heat of the moment all you want, but as a team member, as a strategist, you'd get pretty sick of someone screaming at you and berating you when you're in a team that's given someone a pretty amazing car. And I think in the past that we've seen that kind of behavior build up over time. And I had made a similar tweet and a similar comment about Lewis Hamilton and the way he reacts when a strategy call doesn't go well. Interesting to note, overwhelmingly, Max Verstappen fans told me that it was completely fine and just for Verstappen to show that frustration because his car wasn't working. And in a way, I agree. DRS not working is vital, especially at a track like Barcelona. All I'd ask from the people disagreeing with that tweet is that the same courtesy and luxury is afforded to Lewis Hamilton and Yuki Tsunoda et al. Kyle, then Chris.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's, you know, put yourself in the driver's seat. You're boiling, you're suffering, you're under G-force, it is hot, you're trying your hardest here. And yeah, you know, even the nicest guys in the world can lose their head sometimes and get a bit shouty. Now, Max has shown in the past that he is quite shouty on the radio, but then afterwards it's all absolutely fine. Again, the same with Lewis. Lewis can drop his head and ask questions right in the heat of the moment, like he offered, so he goes, shall we just save the engine? But he didn't know. As soon as he gets told points, but like, it's fine. So yeah, people should give them a bit more slack. And of course, Hamilton will never be held to the same account as everyone else. He will always get a harder time of it. But I think it was fair enough. And yeah, it wasn't very nice the way he delivered the message. But if you're boiling in your own race suit under a lot of G-force trying to get something done, you get a bit hot-headed. I've done it myself in endurance races, and I think I'm a pretty nice guy generally around the paddock. But, but even I've shouted at my team over the radio a few times.
Yeah, of course, of course. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I've shouted at Matt when we've done iRacing Enduros as well. So, you know, I definitely feel him. The worrying thing, though, about this issue is that, according to Helmut Marko, talking to Sky Germany, the issue is as a result of the upgrades on Max's car that were brought this weekend. And, you know, they're on an effort to save some weight in that car.
And this is it. We see with the... They talked about the upgrades, and Verstappen had an upgrade to make the car lighter. Perez didn't, just saying. But again, what we're seeing is these kind of manufacturing type issues from Red Bull. When we had the power unit issues, whatever, in the first few races, you know, there was four power units or related systems going down in the first few races between them and Red Bull B. But yeah, again, you know, they've brought an upgrade, and it's caused what could have been a critical failure. Sorry, John, I know you had a little point there on the radio calls.
Oh, no, I was going to say, but what we don't see is what happens behind the scenes, right? And this is something where they can have really good relationships with their teams, is what I was going to say. Yeah. But just because what we see on air is not actually the relationship. So you can get along really well with these engineers, and just because you have one shouting match does not mean you're not friends anymore.
No, well, absolutely. You only have to look at the Missed Apex team. You know, I've had massive falling out with Brad, with Chris, with Uncle Steve and the rest of you. And, you know, well, we can all still broadly work together. The DRS issue itself was interesting with the terminology when they were saying, you know, oh, you know, maybe just wait until after the curb suppressor. And he said, I'm pressing it like 50 times. I only know from video games, Kyle, but don't you press it once to open it? And then you either press it to close it, or it closes when you do a big lift or when you hit the brake pedal. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll close if you lift. I think it's past 90% throttle or something. There'll be a percentage if you lift, and then, or if you hit the brakes, it will automatically shut. But yeah, you can't really blame him for hitting it so many times. I've done that several times trying to get a button to work, and you hit it like, look. But it was a really interesting comment from Red Bull saying, try pressing the button once after you're curbing. So
what's that? What's curbing?
So they were actually instructing him to run over the sawtooth curbs on the outside of the final corner to cause a bit of vibration, then do it, which is making me think it's a binding up issue or something was not quite working right in the mechanism. So it's quite clever. They were getting him to hit the curb, then hit the button to try and loosen it up.
WD-40, guys. It's not a big deal. Just get some WD-40 on there. My goodness. If it doesn't move and it's supposed to, WD-40. If it's moving and it's not supposed to, duct tape. Engineering isn't really that hard. But there was some really hard racing. I think I want to go back to the Russell battle and the defence and that scrap. It was just quality F1. And in a way, you know, this is classic F1, Chris, because it was a faster car against a slower car on a track where overtaking is hard, but racing was possible. This was almost the best case scenario. We saw lots of probing from Perez and from Verstappen. And then we saw some fantastic defense and car placement from George Russell.
Absolutely. It's just a masterclass in how to defend your position. If you are wondering, you know, if you're an iRacer or something or a Carter, go and watch that and you will see exactly how you should be doing it. I think George Russell was taking a book out of the Alex Van Gene School of Defensive Driving there. Okay. And it was just brilliant. Just wherever, you know, Max wanted to be, George was putting his car there, not being too aggressive, not moving in the braking zone, not making late maneuvers and all this, despite what GP was telling Max over the radio, but just brilliant, brilliant driving and proving exactly why Russell got the promotion to Mercedes, because... Yeah. You know, as much as I rate Valtteri Bottas, he would not have kept Verstappen behind for that long.
Oh, man. And then as soon as Red Bull made that pit crew call about moving in the braking zone and not leaving a car's width, it was accompanied by the shattering sounds of glass breaking from within the Red Bull house. Jono.
Yep. Sorry. My mic is all over the place. Now, with the battle there, it was the classic F1 battle. Now, we spoke about this, I think, after the Saudi race review, how we're like, oh, we don't want to go back to that style of F1. But along that note, I kind of enjoyed, you know, I know we don't want to see no overtakes for 20 laps, but just the whole tense battle where you're wondering, is he going to do it this lap? Look at the car placement here. Oh, he's poking a nose here. They're alongside each other. All that kind of stuff all over the place. I was on the edge of my seat for 10, 15 laps watching that. I did not want to see him just sail past after two laps. I just didn't enjoy that kind of F1, and I don't.
And I think the one that you might have appreciated, Kyle, was obviously Perez was stuck behind Russell for lap after lap after lap in that first stint. And you could see that Perez knew he needed to get past, even losing some body work into turn one. But when he came to the second attempt to pass Russell, he sold him a dummy based on those previous battles, knowing that Russell was really good at defending that inside. He seemed to just gently put him to the point where he would normally require Russell to defend the inside and then just sail down the outside. And there was just lots of that stuff where you need to do things over the course of many laps, not just a few corners.
Yeah, quite often overtaking moves build up via several laps, and also with the battery charge and where you recharge and save it all up for a massive attack. Now, when Perez finally did get past him, I actually think that he did the work in the final chicane. He got close enough to him in the final chicane and had enough battery left so he could essentially get past him before the braking zone almost. But how George was driving was quite clever. And also he was using Max's tactics, his own tactics against him, was moving late in the braking zone. Most people, if they go to defend, they'll make a decisive move really early. Mm. And that essentially opens the door for the other person to breeze down the outside. So George was keeping them guessing, watching his mirrors, and then moving quite late. So then the other car had to quickly jink out right at the point of the braking zone. So he played it really, really well. But also, I think what's really key to note here in these battles, particularly into turn one versus last year, is the new directives and the race directives, whatever they're telling him in the driver's briefing, is working. Because when Verstappen got the run and managed to go up the inside of George, he managed to sort of get him on the hop a bit and went up the inside. Oh, it's definitely done now. He's just going to let the brakes off and run around. But Verstappen didn't. He actually pulled up and left the car's width on the outside, which we didn't see at any point last year.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely fair. So George could come around the outside of him. So I think it's testament to these new sort of racing and these new sort of rules of engagement and whatever they're telling them in the driver's briefing, because they're all adhering to it religiously. Like, nobody has tried to do a full wang up the inside and just run the other driver off. We haven't seen it yet.
That's a good point. That I didn't think of that at the time. But that exact same maneuver last year against Hamilton, 100% Verstappen is going all the way to the outside and Hamilton is off or having to back up. And he's not doing that. And I don't believe that Verstappen has had like a moment where the heavens and the angels have descended on him and said, no, you know, no, Max, you know, that's wrong. You shouldn't do it. This is not a moral decision. Clearly, the FIA have stamped down rules wise and made it very clear that that will not wash this season. Chris,
that was the best moment, wasn't it? When
good.
You thought the move was done.
So good.
And Russell just says, no, I'm not having any of it. I'm just going to go around the outside, take the position straight back again. Just brilliant.
Yeah. And then I guess, Carl, the other bit of like contentious racing in that was, firstly, actually, do you think that Russell was moving in the braking zone? Because we should remind people of the rules. You were not allowed to specifically change your line whilst braking.
No, but also there is another sort of open-ended comment in the rules, which is like you're allowed to regain your line on the way into the corner. So it's a bit kind of open-ended. Was Russell fair? Ultimately, I think he was. Was it on the edge? Yes, it was. It was on the edge. But again, it's one of these new generation of young drivers. Verstappen started it when he came in. We see it with Norris even. We see it with Leclerc. They're all very, very aggressive, but right up to the line. So I think it was fair. I almost choked on the irony of some of the radio comments from Weekly and Ramble coming out.
Well, that,
but it was ultimately fair, but it was right on the edge. I think one occasion he moved back aggressively to take the to take his line to the corner, but he did just about leave a car's width. And I think this is the crucial bit. He didn't do the full chop right in front of him. So I think this is why the stewards didn't tell him off.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a few things there to probably just a bit of revision for myself to make sure I've got this. As I understand it, the way it is enforced is if you're going, you know, down a straight with a car about to overtake you, obviously you can then go and defend all the way to the inside if you want. And we saw Russell defend all the way to the inside, but you don't want to be on the inside to take the corner. So you can move back to take up your line. But what you can't do is then move all the way back across and also block the outside. So you get to choose which one you want to block. And generally, Carl, you know, people will be defensive on the inside. And we saw Verstappen and Perez really exploring where the tarmac runs out onto grass. And you go, that's your cutoff point to make a decision down the inside and then go back to the outside. And then naturally, Russell will follow back to the outside. But then he's got to leave that racing room on the outside.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to compromise himself too much for the exit. And also, I think his car whips are taking into account the white line and a bit of the curb. So he can get the other car can get two wheels off on the other side. And like the turn three incident, well, it wasn't really an incident when he kind of almost ran him off. Verstappen was never fully alongside him at that point. So I think they have other rules where they say the car on the inside, it's their corner. It was all fair at the end of the day. But another really clever sort of aspect to George's defense was how he finished the defense. So once he's actually managed to stay ahead of Verstappen in turn one, going through two, he's in no hurry really to pick that throttle up.
Exactly.
He's in no hurry. It's called parking it on the apex.
Yeah.
And so he was doing that quite a lot, which is wrong footing Verstappen. And also I noticed in turn three, he was actively going where Verstappen was behind him to give him the dirty air. So he was keeping it tight when Verstappen was. And as soon as Verstappen went out wider, George then reacted. It's a trick Michael Schumacher used to do, which is keeping an eye on the mirror where the car is behind. And he was purposely getting that dirty air onto Max's car. So I think he was being a bit more wily than it first seemed in his defense.
See, the thing is, Chris, I've not been a massive George Russell fan because just nothing... I know, but just nothing. He's been fighting Latifi and Kubica. Like, okay, kind of great. Well done. You're working your way up the ladder. And then, you know, it's been a good start to this, you know, Mercedes campaign as well. But this defense, and especially that one fighting back when Verstappen had it done, my F1 heart, it fluttered. It fluttered a little bit. And a little bit of fandom grew inside my heart for George Russell. Just a little. Just to start.
Yeah. I mean, this is why we watch Formula One, isn't it? It's the absolute peak of racing ability. And I think the reason we don't see battles like this more often is because that was costing them both a lot of time.
Yeah.
But George was in a rather enviable position where he knows he's not going to fight Leclerc for the win. He knows that, you know, he was in second place.
Leclerc
he
was in this race.
Second place a little bit as well with Sainz and Verstappen going off. So he knows that this is the best he's going to get and he's going to fight for it.
Yeah.
So he was willing to lose time to Leclerc for that fight.
He's also got to tell the team as well. He's got to announce himself to the team. Like, I really am here. I am good. I am doing a job, because I know people will hate us for this. I cannot imagine Bottas doing that same job. He had 3, 4, 5 years to prove that. And he never showed that kind of performance at Mercedes. But the second part of Verstappen's race was Perez. So once they cleared Bottas once they cleared Russell with the strategy that Carl mentioned earlier, going onto the softs, being aggressive, unlocking the pace and tyre management that we previously didn't know whether Verstappen had, really the only obstacle then, Chris, was Perez.
Yeah, so a little bit of luck with Leclerc falling out of the race.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. Yeah.
With the reliability. I would have loved to have seen how that would have panned out with Leclerc making it to the finish. But, you know, it makes sense for Red Bull to just, okay, we can't get past Russell. Just get him in some clean air, bang in some lap times, and we will come out ahead by the end of this. And I don't think they quite foresaw the scenario where they would end up being 1-2 with Perez ahead as well. Because I think initially Perez was going to be making one stop less.
Yeah, and the one stop was kind of working a little bit.
I don't know if the one stop was going to work. The one stop, the two stop maybe. I think that was the initial plan. But I think then with Russell and co kind of making it on three stops as well, they didn't really have anything to lose by making that third stop, because they know they want Verstappen to win the race.
I was thinking about this earlier, is betting on Sergio Perez to win a race one of the worst things you can do? Because even when he's got a chance, he's going to be forced to move out of the way. So the only chance you've ever got to make money on that is if Verstappen is out of the race and somehow Perez has the fastest car. So it's almost like the worst thing you could place a bet on.
So to be fair to Red Bull, Perez is showing some pace this season, and in Miami that was masked by a loss of power, but I think this is the best Perez Red Bull package that we've seen so far. It might not be a massively high bar for everyone. So this is the first time he's starting to give Red Bull this headache, Chris.
Yeah, so one of the questions that I got on Twitter after the race, if you don't follow the Mr. Apex Twitter account, I answer questions on that for an hour or so after each Grand Prix.
At Mr. Apex F1?
That's the one. And one of the questions I got was, you know, what does Perez have to do to actually win a race? And I said, well, he has to be in victory contention when Max is not.
Mm.
You know, if they're both in contention, then Max will be given the go-ahead and Perez will be told to let him through. But if Max, for whatever reason, he's out of the race, he's out of contention because he's had a puncture or something, that is the only way Perez is going to win races.
Okay, but Mercedes, retrospectively, might be thinking that they missed a little bit of a trick today. And in the heat of battle, yeah, you fight for your position. And look, even though Russell was fighting for positions, he ultimately probably wasn't going to keep and knew he wasn't going to keep. You've got to respect the fight. And from a Mercedes point of view, being up there in the lead, fighting for the win, that carried so much weight. But once Verstappen was behind, Russell and Mercedes could have pulled a blinder. They could have let Perez through and said, hey, you know, this is not our fight. But then being a bit more dogged with Verstappen, create an inter-team struggle with them, put a gap of like 15 to 20 seconds between their number two driver and their number one driver and cause tons of chaos. What's wrong with that, Jono?
Well, it's a convoluted thing to think about. The problem I have with it is, so if you're in Perez's situation, right? So we start off with the fact that, is he actually doing well? Because so now that Mercedes are the third quickest team, you can't be 3-4 tenths off Verstappen and be like, oh, Perez is doing well. He's in fourth. He's keeping that car competetive. Now he's being out-qualified by Russell.
Oh, hang on a minute. Quali's quali. Let's talk about the race. The race was today. No, we know there's a quali deficit.
I know that.
Hang on a second. No, sorry, Jono. Sorry. I know people don't like me interrupting, but they don't have the same car. He's at least an upgrade behind most of the time. So he's got a heavier car. They don't give him the same priority on tactics. They don't give him the same priority, say, for going. Other teams will swap where drivers get preferential treatment about who goes out. Let's remember, Perez is a clear number two in every resource area of the team.
I do agree with that, and that is the leeway for him, and that's the sort of grace period we give him, is the fact that he doesn't have the same car. He's in that sort of second position. But along with that is he can't now, with a third team that's about to be competitive because Mercedes are starting to climb up the order, he just cannot be 2-3 tenths off anymore, because now he's going to start to, oh, Red Bull all of a sudden have the fastest car, but I'm 3 tenths off Verstappen. Oh, I'm sixth and I'm no longer third or fourth. And that's the problem now for Perez, in like when it comes into that situation. Yes, his race pace was very good today. I agree. He did very well. But if you take Verstappen's spin out of it, it's a completely different race. And if Verstappen has a clean race and he never makes mistakes, usually Verstappen is way up the road in comparison to Sergio.
Yeah. And I kind of agree. I agree with Red Bull's tactics. Sorry, Spanners, but boo. It's a complete, you two, both of you, boo. It's a complete and utter no-brainer. I know Mercedes have come in for flak for this in the past, but it's a complete no-brainer. I mean, all their eggs, and they've made no bones about it. Yeah. They have been pretty open with it. Like, all of their eggs are in Verstappen's basket. So I was quite surprised to hear Sergio so frustrated with it. It must be, again, heat of the moment. Again, it's frustrated at the time. Did he seriously think that he was going to hold Verstappen off? Did he seriously think that they was going to do that? And also, it was always for the team. Yes, his strategy was slightly compromised, but as soon as Leclerc dropped out of the race, Red Bull were like, right, we need our number one guy maximizing the points. I'm really surprised they didn't stop him in the end to go for fastest lap as well. They probably didn't want the risk with the climbing temperatures.
So it wasn't just the heat of the moment. He was doing it, you know, a good hour after the race in the pen and stuff. I think, much like no one told Felipe Massa he was a number two, I don't think it's quite like that with Perez, but I think he thought he was going to get a fairer shake of the stick. So if you just look at the race quickly and just quickly look at Perez's key moments, he was asked to let Verstappen through to have a go at Russell. Now, that is on Perez, because had he got past on the, at the start in turn one, and he sure did give it a go. That wouldn't have been an issue. Had he been able to make a more decisive move against George Russell, it wouldn't be an issue because he'd been clear and gone. And but what you had there is, you know, a very, very good defensive driver against not one of the best attacking drivers on the field in the form of Sergio Perez. But then when he had the tyres, when he'd made the longer stint work and had fresh tyres to come through, they didn't just say, OK, Max, it's not happening with Russell. Let Perez through to do his own race. It wasn't even a consideration. They could have swapped it back later on, but it was no consideration to let him go and do his strategy. And then later on in the race, he was taken off that one stop for good or for ill, probably wouldn't have won it anyway. But when Max comes up to him, he is then told, you're on a different strategy. If he's faster, let him go. The other way around, Perez was faster and had more of a chance to get past Russell, as he demonstrated, but he wasn't allowed to go. So I can see why he felt hard done by, but you're only hard done by if you haven't been told you're an out-and-out number two with no chance of winning a race. Sorry, Chris.
I think we can sit back and say, oh, well, he clearly was never going to hold back Verstappen on fresh tyres, but he has to believe that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, he may as well just give up and retire and
well,
not do
Barcelona. You can defend in Barcelona.
Exactly. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, but Red Bull have learned the hard way that letting your drivers race is an incredibly risky strategy. Mercedes has learnt it the hard way as well. And that's why we get such strict team orders now about you are not racing, okay? Max is quicker at the end of the race, and he's the guy going for the world championship. Perez just isn't. And it's the same at Ferrari with Carlos Sainz as well.
Now,
that
yeah.
spin for him has put the final nail in the coffin. He is now number two. He will be asked to let Leclerc through any time for the rest of the season. Now, not that Leclerc will probably ever be behind him. We haven't even seen it at all this
Savage.
Season.
But a little bit of pre-Sainz bashing. We haven't even got there yet, Chris.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
For the sake of balance and in Perez's defense, you are right. As soon as Verstappen come up behind him, it was instantly pretty much out the way. As soon as he had a chance to get in the mix, it's like, no, sit there and wait. And then again, instantly through. So but that should have told him, if he hasn't been told behind the scenes and he hasn't already figured it out, that really should have told him the story. He knows that he's never going to be able to take points from Verstappen, particularly when Red Bull is so worried about Ferrari. But yeah, it must be a bitter pill to swallow.
Well, they said they're going to have a conversation later, so it will be interesting to, we'll probably not be privy to it. But what I think is that Red Bull probably made certain chats and certain assurances when he was nowhere near Verstappen's pace. And I just get a feeling this season, no, he's not going to ultimately be, you know, out-qualifying Verstappen race after race, event after event. But he looks to have got a grip with this car and this tyre model, and it looks like he can do things on race pace, especially if Pirelli, as I instructed them to, turn up with more two-stop, three-stop races. I think Perez is a genuine asset, but also a genuine danger to his competitors on the track.
I think the issue for Perez as well is, you know, if he doesn't like the situation at Red Bull, where's he going to go? He's not going to go anywhere else. There's no other team that will take him at this point, especially at his age.
Oh, wow. Harsh.
And so he can either stay at Red Bull and occasionally fight for a win when something happens to Max, or he can give up and try something else if he wants to.
Johnny. That's where I'm thinking, if Perez starts to become a bit of a jerk and goes, well, I don't want to be number two anymore, I want to start beating Verstappen, who can Red Bull go and get? That's number two. And he is replaceable, yes, for sure. But also Perez is doing such a good job in that role that I hope Red Bull begin to manage and be like, well, look, we need to manage Perez here because he's done such a great job supporting Verstappen to his first world title. We need him to keep doing the same things for these next few years.
All right. Well, I mean, we've covered Red Bull in some depth there and touched upon some of the woes of Ferrari and the great performance from George Russell. But there were two other drivers in the silver and red cars as well. I think let's go to the Mercedes race. I think both drivers really, really impressed today, as did the team. And in the last news show, I said, yeah, well, it was, from an engineering point of view, it was time for Mercedes to put up and shut up. The time for chats was over. If they didn't turn up to the Spanish Grand Prix with a package that could be competitive, it was done. And that was kind of ruined on turn one. They halved their chances of getting a win, where Lewis Hamilton ended up colliding with Kevin Magnussen, allowing us to play this game.
Whose fault is it?
So, here at Missed Apex Podcast, we do not acknowledge any such thing as a racing incident. There is always someone mostly to blame. Turn three, Lewis Hamilton found himself choked up behind Carlos Sainz, and then into turn four, Kevin Magnussen was able to make a run around the outside. Whose fault was it? I will go to my panel. Jono.
It's as simple as this, okay? Rational mindset first. So Magnussen's gone and made a great move, and he's tried to go around the outside. But the problem is, as the overtaking driver, you're responsible to take the most care in placing the overtake. Now, he's gone and squeezed Hamilton with no margin for error. What Magnussen should be doing is leaving a bit of space to say, hey, Hamilton could make a mistake here. He could understeer. He could have some oversteer. He hasn't left that margin for error. Hamilton's done nothing wrong. I don't think he's washed himself wide on purpose, as Magnussen claimed. I think that's a heat of the moment, sort of tongue-in-cheek kind of thing. I don't know what Magnussen was talking about there. Yeah, I think it was purely a racing incident, but definitely more fault on Magnussen's side for not taking more care and space in making the overtake.
Kyle.
Yeah, I agree with John Adair. I think racing incident was the correct assessment by the stewards from a stewarding point of view.
But
from
you?
Our point of view, yeah, I'd say it's K-Mag's fault. Now, there's a couple of things to consider here. That one that John has briefly touched on was when you're the inside driver there, and if you see where K-Mag is going into the corner with Hamilton, K-Mag's quite far back. It is a massive lunge down the outside. It is quite a move. Hamilton is probably not even aware he's there. He's not certainly not checking, looking on his outside. He's fully focused on trying to get rid of the air wash and not run into the back of Carlos Sainz and trying to set him up for the exit. So that's why he said, I've been hit. Not I've run into somebody. It's like, I've been hit, because he's probably not even aware. The first he knew about it was when K-Mag actually hit him. So, and when you're going around the outside like that, particularly if it's a lunge and you're coming from fully behind to then side by side, you need to allow a bit of room on the inside, because it's the first lap, the cars are heavy, there's a lot of aero wash, expect the car on the inside to run wide ever so slightly, and he left absolutely zero margin.
Yeah, I was very surprised the amount of damage that it did to Lewis's car, when you consider that Russell and Perez had their own bit of contact at turn one, and probably was a harder hit actually, and they both got away scot-free. But you know, it's a shame, because Lewis was the strategic variant there, starting on the medium tire. We never got to see how that panned out, but that's the risk of starting on that tire.
Yeah,
because the soft tires will get fired up straight away. Everyone's got a lot more grip around you. There was a risk he was going to get swallowed up, caught up in an incident, and it obviously happened. Today it didn't pan out.
Yeah, and well, I want to defend Magnussen a little bit here, whereas I agree that it's Magnussen's fault. I do agree that it's mostly Magnussen's fault. That turn, and this is why I teed this up earlier, Kyle, you have to get that corner correct and to be on the power the whole time, you need to have your line early. So Magnussen would have found himself in a position with an unnaturally slowing Lewis Hamilton, who was having to check up and be in the wash of signs and being limited by signs ahead. Magnussen finds himself on the outside with nowhere to go. As a racer, his options there were to brake. And I know people are saying he should have left more room, but going outside and leaving more room at turn four in Barcelona is the same as braking, because you're not going to make that corner in one big acceleration sweep. So Magnussen was really faced in the heat of the moment a situation where he just found himself in the position to get alongside Hamilton, and we're all expecting him to just lift, which he should have done to avoid the incident, but he didn't. It was almost an accidental overtake. He found himself there and then tried to pursue the natural overtaking line. Chris, then Kyle.
Right, okay, yeah, but it doesn't really matter if you're caught up in the pack or not. You can't turn in when there's a car alongside you and expect there to not be contact.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it's savage to say that Hamilton drifted out into Magnussen, because you don't hug the curb necessarily there. And he was very far over to the right anyway.
That was ludicrous.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so sad he said that.
Well, you're talking about the commentary team.
No. Magnussen said it. I like K-Mag, but not kosher.
Kyle.
Yeah, I was going to say his comment immediately afterwards was ridiculous.
It was stupid.
It was a bit silly.
Well,
but again,
why would he deliberately? Well,
yeah, exactly. Why on earth would you do that? It's the same thing of Adrian Newey's made a couple of ridiculous comments saying that Lewis did a professional foul at Silverstone. Of course you're not going to do that, because you're going to hurt your own race. So why on earth would you try to do something like that? Now, Magnussen, he had a meter or two on the left-hand side. What I think he really didn't want to do was get anywhere near the dirty outside bit of the track. So he was leaning up against Lewis and he tried to squeeze him as much as he possibly could, but he just took a little bit too much. We're talking fine margins here. So
and cold tyres.
And cold tyres and aero wash in front of them. So this is why I think it was a correct call by the race stewards to not bother looking into it, because you could see what he was trying to do. He just slightly misjudged it and tried to squeeze a bit too much.
Last one, Chris.
Well, that being said, what a recovery drive from Lewis Hamilton, though. I mean, getting, what was he, 50 seconds off the lead? I mean, he was last, for sure, having to replace the tyre at the end of lap one. So effectively then was on a two-stop to the end of the race and still brought it home in a very, very competitive position, had great pace. I think we were 100% looking at Lewis Hamilton as a podium contender, maybe even challenging one of the balls.
Whisper it.
For something further up, because Mercedes has definitely improved its race pace.
Counter.
The qualifying pace is still a little to be desired, but in the race, they're getting there.
A counter from our angry young Australian.
No, I think Lewis's pace was incredible today, but I think that the Red Bulls were too far ahead. They were by far the quickest car. The Ferraris, definitely right today. I mean, Lewis even challenged Sainz and he was last on, what was it, the first lap or whatever. So yes, he definitely had the Ferraris, but looking at his race pace, incredible. That was insane stuff. And I know people are going to comment and be like, oh, all you guys talk about is compliment Lewis Hamilton and his great race, but it's like, look at his pace. It was incredible. You know, he had some great lap times. Russell was superb today. That's by far the best driver pairing on the grid.
Well, Toto Wolff said that Hamilton had the best race pace on the grid. And I was watching the lap times all the way through. And in the first stint, when he got his head down, and that was so sad to hear that, oh God, he obviously felt responsible. He felt like he'd let the team down having that contact. And he's gone, oh God, don't worry about me. Just save the engine. Here I am, talent the size of a planet, and I've let you all down. Just save the engine and let me go. And the race engineers just calmly said, no, this point's keep on going. That first stint, it didn't look very encouraging, because he had to go onto the softs and make them last and eke them out. But when he went onto his second stint, he was popping. I think he was one of the first cars to pop into the 26s, and he was lighting it up with the purples, Kyle.
Yeah, there was it was consecutive laps as well that he was knocking in the fastest lap. So they weren't sort of save your battery up specials either. Mm. It was genuine race pace. And as Chris touched on earlier, it was such a tragedy we didn't get to see him on the alternate strategy. So, and I think this adds to him feeling responsible, as you say, and apologising, because I think he knew starting on those mediums, I think he was quietly confident today of being able to take the fight for maybe for the win, because as lots of people have mentioned, he'd actually clawed time before his problem at the end. He actually clawed time back on Verstappen throughout the race, and the actual race pace was incredible. And I think why he was slow in the first stint was he knew he was going long on those softs. So he was being really gentle on them, very gentle on them. And just to touch on his radio comment, when he made that radio comment, he was still trying to get a broken car back to the pits, I think, or he'd just come out. The rest of the pack he couldn't even see. He was 38 seconds behind the next car, and he was like, this is impossible to score points. And of course, you get your head down. As soon as they told him, no, we reckon we can still get points, he suddenly came back to life again. But yeah, I mean, he was gutted, but I think that's because he was quietly confident. I think that's because he knew he had some mega pace under him.
Yeah, but if that was Russell, that would have been a safety car, eh, Jono? It would have helped Russell, the safety car.
The conspiracy theory. Oh, do we go down that path?
45 consecutive safety car races and just this one without.
Well, I will bring up Imola last year, and Lewis Hamilton did have that red flag. Nope. But anyway,
yeah, that was super lucky.
he did get a lot of luck through that one. Now, number one, can I just go to what should I start with? Let's go with the strategy. So Lewis has tried Russell's Miami strategy, which was very good, and Russell had a great race. So that was number one. That's why he was very disappointed. Number two, like, are we just getting to know Lewis Hamilton or what? Like, come on, this guy's worn his heart on his sleeve for 15 years. Like, why are people acting like this is new?
Yeah, it's a good point. However, if you're hoping for a Lewis Hamilton resurgence, the next race is Monaco. And as a Lewis Hamilton fan, I can't remember the last time we had a good... When was the last time we had a good Monaco and everything went well, Chris? It seems to me like everything always seems to crumble at Monaco.
Well, he won in 2019.
That was ages ago. Stop living in the past, Chris.
Pre-pandemic.
They didn't have the race in 2020, so they couldn't.
Oh, right.
I feel you there because the Mercedes didn't look fantastic in quali trim in that final sector, which is the slower part of the lap, and that doesn't really bode all that well for Monaco. Just to confirm, it was a water leak on both cars at the end of the race, which is why they're having to do the mad lift and coast. For Russell, it didn't make any difference to his position, but of course it did cost Lewis that fourth place finish.
Can I add to that as well is, look, I don't want to go into Monaco too early because we still got to review Mercedes' race, but the whole porpoising issue for Mercedes, and I go, well, we're going to a low-speed track at Monaco, porpoising sort of affects the car more in high-speed corners and all that kind of stuff. Honestly, like, Mercedes could go very well at Monaco. Like we saw last year with a surprise Ferrari result, we could see Monaco very good for Mercedes. But back to this race, Lewis, look, he said that on the opening laps. He's going to cop flak for it. He said it his entire career. He wears his heart in his sleeve. Let's move on. The guy had a great race.
But what Hamilton says isn't always a massive indicator of then what he's going to do. It's not always predictive of results. Oh, man, these tyres are gone. Then sets the fastest lap. He is emotional. He is down on himself. He does express himself in this kind of heart on his sleeve way. And whilst Verstappen's style might be more screaming down the radio about the amount of times he's pressed a button, a record amount of times, Paul de Resta said, Lewis Hamilton wears that kind of more, that negative energy that he gets. He just gets it out and he expresses it and he says it. And if Verstappen's engineers are used to his style, then, you know, Hamilton's engineers are probably used to the kind of the shoulders down, head down Hamilton. But you could see, Carl, that, you know, he did get over that. It didn't result in him just parking it.
No. And you could see in his interviews at the end of the race, he was quite sort of buoyed. And you can see that the glint back in the eye, and he's quietly confident because he knew he had monster race pace today and he was probably ruining. I think if he would have got away, especially on that alternate strategy, I think he definitely could have troubled maybe Verstappen and Leclerc. Definitely would have been a nailed on third. But I don't think we may have seen the last of Moody Lewis for this season now. I think he's now quietly confident.
I'll take that bet, to be fair. I think that's quite a brave bet, Carl. Jono.
So if you look at the six races so far, it's sort of been three for Russell, three for Hamilton. They've been so even, you know. I don't want to actually go list all six races, but if you've actually looked at who's been quicker on pace, it's been pretty even so far. So I think in the Spanish race, yeah, Russell performed really well. I'll give this race to Russell. That makes it three apiece. But Hamilton's pace on the lap time sheets, that's something to look out for. That was very, very impressive for the future.
I would just go a little bit simpler than that and say they both had very impressive races for different reasons. If anything, after the Magnussen incident, Hamilton had a much easier race and could show pace more clearly. Obviously, Russell had to use up tyres for that brilliant defence. So I know there was people going, oh, well, look, Hamilton closed up to within 11 seconds from 50 seconds. That doesn't tell the story of the race. Russell had a much harder time of it on the tyres and fighting. And to be honest, Russell's covered himself in glory completely this race, but Hamilton has shown a quiet strength in his car as well.
Yeah, and as Chris alluded to earlier, he essentially did it on a two-stop. He would have been the only person in the top six actually to make a two-stop work. I think Leclerc probably would have two-stopped if he hadn't retired, but Hamilton pitted on lap one off the soft tyre, off the medium. He then went onto his soft tyres and then got a mammoth, I think it was 21 laps out of them, and then a really nice medium stint as well. So it was essentially a two-stop, and he was still quick and still had tyre life. So he did say the setups were slightly different. They experimented with George in qualifying, so maybe George's tyres munched a little bit, but Hamilton, the tyre wear is there and the pace is there. So roll on another representative track. I know people like us calling representative tracks.
It's not Monaco, is it? Very briefly, because we've touched on some of these talking points already, but obviously devastating for Ferrari. Like, I am sorry. Listen to me, Tifosi. Listen to the sound of my voice falling upon your ears years ago. Right, if that had been Vettel in 2017 or Alonso or Schumacher, I would have taken a little bit of joy in that failure. I'm not too big. I'm not claiming the moral high ground that I wouldn't have done. Today, I felt that because, you know, Leclerc picked himself up after that Q3 spin and delivered a lap. But really, that Q3 spin, indicative of where Leclerc may go wrong in this title hunt, needs to cut that out. Putting himself under unnecessary pressure with a pole-sitting car, pulled it out of the bag this time, well done. But Ferrari needs to be perfect to beat Red Bull, and it's not happening. But my heart did break when he had that power loss, because I do think that that was a very, very comfortable lead. I cannot imagine the race circumstance where on pace and strategy alone, Red Bull caught up to them. Of course, Verstappen made a mistake. Sainz made a mistake. Hamilton got himself caught up in an incident. Perez and got himself stuck behind George Russell and hit George Russell. So in that pack, Leclerc had done everything right and was going to win, Chris, and I was crushed for him. Genuinely, Tifosi, genuinely.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's so emotional on the radio. How many times have we heard that cry of defeat,
every Monaco Grand Prix?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's already binned it at Monaco car, so at the historic. So maybe he's ticked his box for this year. But, you know, that Q3... classic Charles Leclerc mental fortitude. Put that at the back of the mind, go out, bang in pole position. That's just brilliant stuff. And the kind of thing we see from Charles Leclerc is one of his biggest strengths is his mental fortitude to just get the job done. Of course, the obvious one I always think of was that tragic weekend when his father died, when he was in Formula 2 in Baku, and he went out and just absolutely dominated the field. And you're right. How many times does it happen where all the dominoes were just falling into place for him? Hamilton, the strategic variant, got knocked out. His nearest rivals crumbling like clay. It just doesn't happen. And, you know, this was an easy win that was taken away from him.
Poor, poor Ferrari. Spanners, honestly, this is not a joke. When when the race finished, I actually said to myself, should I make fun of Ferrari on today's podcast or should I actually show sympathy for the first time in a decade? And I'm actually sympathetic for him. I feel sorry for Ferrari. Finally, a car that can win a championship, and they've had one of the worst starts to a season. I remember Red Bull in 2010 had a really good car, and they just had such poor performances to begin the year. This is like that. Yeah. Now, they went on to win the title, so that's the silver lining that we paint for Ferrari fans. But if you rank the top six drivers from these top three teams and who's done the best in terms of maximizing their season, it's been Russell, definitely number one. Leclerc fits in the top three somewhere, but Sainz is last.
Yeah.
Like, what a terrible start in the best car.
We can't sugarcoat this, can we, guys? Like, it has been mistake after mistake. Probably the Australian Grand Prix was, you know, one of the early ones. And you go, you chalk those up to experience. And you go, okay, it's time to pick yourself up and move on, Kyle. But he hasn't.
No, he hasn't. And I've sat here on this podcast in front of many people and rooted for him. And I think lots of people are rooting for him.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame that he just isn't putting it together. And with the anti-stall on the start, I'm wondering whether he's feeling the pressure a little bit.
Is anti-stall a driver error or a mechanical error?
I think it's probably a driver error. Probably not enough revs on when he dropped the clutch, and he instantly reacted. If you just dip the clutch in again, or the car reacted. But yeah, I think I'd probably put that down to driver error, and the team hasn't come out and said that it was a car issue. So maybe a bit jittery at the start, but yeah, as Chris said, I think that's the final nail in the coffin for him now. He's going to be the nailed on number two. And as Benotto said, he just said Carlos is struggling to deal with running an aggressive balance like Leclerc can. And they just think it's Leclerc who's driving much better than him than Carlos driving badly. So he has pretty much painted himself as the set on number two now. I just really hope for his sake and his confidence sake, he can snatch a win by the end of the season. He's becoming like a Barrichello in Braun 2009. Type sort of driver. I think hopefully he'll just catch a win by the end of the season.
It's amazing how quickly our perceptions of these drivers can change, because pre-season, a lot of people were backing Sainz to challenge Leclerc for the title this year, especially after such an impressive maiden season at Ferrari last year. His stock was very high, but it is so quickly. Here we are 3 months later, and we've got a completely opposite viewpoint of this Leclerc-Sainz.
Well, I remember you, Matt, and Kyle having that viewpoint. I remember that a lot. Yeah. I don't remember me and Jono having that viewpoint.
A lot of people did. Oh. A lot of people.
Well, who were these people? Like the whole paddock or something? I don't remember this happening. I've always thought Leclerc was by far way better than Carlos Sainz. Now, Carlos Sainz is tremendous, but that's how good Leclerc is, a generational talent. Let's put it like that. But going back to what Kyle said, like, okay, Sainz has struggled in the car, but Leclerc has as well. Imola, that stupid spin he had. You look at the spinning qualifying, he's had some other moments as well. Like, Leclerc hasn't had it easy. That car might be a difficult car to drive.
It might be. And also, I think you might be being a bit premature calling Leclerc a generational talent. Sauber, who was his teammate at Sauber? Ericsson? Yeah. And then Vettel, who really hasn't been the same since the hybrid era. Has he really proved himself?
I have this feeling, I have this theory that anybody who wins Formula 2 or GP2 back in the day in their first year of competition generally is a generational talent. So you've got Lewis Hamilton, Nico Rosberg, George Russell. There's somebody else in there, Nico Hülkenberg. Let's forget about that. But there's been a lot of other guys who are very good who have done it. And that's my theory on that. Norris, I think, did it. Or did he do F? He did F2, yeah.
No, he did F3. But he didn't win it.
He was in the Russell season, though. So
yeah, same with Albon.
Mm. Yeah, Kyle, sorry.
With this, and I was vouching for Sainz to come out on top purely from not making a little mistakes. I mean, Leclerc has been known for it. Thinking Baku 2019 and the Charles comment over the radio where he bins it in qualifying, and as Johnny said, we have seen some little mistakes this season. They just haven't been so bad. But I fully agree. I think the Ferrari is a very difficult car to drive. It's bouncing more than any other car. It just happens to be quick. And Carlos is struggling with it. And every race that goes by where he's still struggling to match Leclerc. And I think his qualifying performances, as he said in Bahrain. He said he was lost in Bahrain, but just pulled out a decent lap just to get himself up there in qualifying, and then he's just slipped back in every single race. We haven't seen him strong in a single race yet, and every race that goes by, it just snowballs and gets worse. So he really needs a strong result.
And what I've noticed as well is that Ferrari is obviously very quick in qualifying. Like, it's almost a Saturday car compared to Sunday. Sure. So have they set that car up to be pointy and very good on one lap, but it doesn't save the tyre as well? It's not good to drive over long distances. That could be a problem too.
Yeah, every race where Verstappen has not conked out, I think in all those races, has Leclerc been on pole and then Verstappen has chewed him up on pace and tyre wear. So, you know, that's not very encouraging. We're yet to see the Ferraris go out and just beat them on pace in a race, aren't we?
I think Bahrain, maybe. But of course, the Red Bull then was not as optimised as it is now. I think Ferrari had a bit more of a jump on the rest of the field compared to now, for example, okay. Where I would comfortably say the Red Bull is probably the best car in the races. But the general consensus, the theme I'm seeing is that the Ferrari is very quick in qualifying, so you'll get a Leclerc on pole, but the Red Bull will hunt them down in the races.
Yeah, and I think that's correct. The Red Bull definitely looks like the faster race car, but that's why it's a bit irritating. It's why Verstappen's mistake is almost a bit irritating, because it was just, I was looking forward to how it was brewing up with Leclerc. Like, have Ferrari with these new upgrades got on top of their tyre wear, and can he go in a head straight fight with Verstappen? And it was brewing up for that, and we got denied to see the chance. And Leclerc ended up doing a monster stint because he was allowed to by the George Russell battle and the cork in the Red Bull bottle and couldn't get through. So we didn't get a good view of how, if Ferrari have got on top of their tyre wear. So they may well have done. Like, if you looked just purely on paper, it would indicate that, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. So we're going to have to wait until Canada and Baku until we actually know whether their upgrades have worked properly.
Okay, we've got to move on because obviously we want to stay under our 1 hour strict time limit. We do believe that an hour is the optimal time that you will want to listen. We try to kind of make this around your commute, so we don't want to, you know, go on and have this going on so long that you cannot listen to it once you get home and you've got responsibilities like stupid children to look after. But there was more than six cars in this grid. I was really, really disappointed to see Ricciardo just getting swallowed up by Norris. So Norris got disqualified from Q2. So did he start 15th? Yeah, Q2 was the track limit, so he didn't make it into Q3.
Well, he didn't get disqualified.
He got the lap invalidated.
Yeah, he would have been in Q3 otherwise.
All right. Well, it worked out the same, Mr. Actually. My goodness. Okay. So what I'm saying is he got that lap time deleted, which was very unfortunate. And people are saying, well, why not just let the gravel be the track limits? Because there's not gravel at every track. Do you know what is at every track? The white line. So that's good. Let's just keep the white line.
Yes, although I do agree, they probably should just move that gravel like 2 inches forward and then it's a non-issue at all. But do you know what? What a job by Lando Norris. Not only did he mince Daniel Ricciardo today, he raced with tonsillitis that got diagnosed after the race.
Oh,
what a stellar job.
Okay, COVID, you mean?
I thought it was COVID.
No, it was tonsillitis.
Was it now? Okay. All right, fair enough. Was it not hay fever, are you sure?
No, I'm pretty sure. It was diagnosed by a doctor.
Okay, so fine, Kyle.
I was about to say, the battle was so good at the front and it was so intriguing that I kind of took my eye off the midfield a little bit. But I think
I think we all did. Yeah.
Great stand-up performers there. We had Norris gutted about Ricciardo's struggles. That's one of the biggest surprises on the grid. He's gone back to his first year last year at McLaren and the struggles didn't look good at all. But Tsunoda had a really strong race as well, getting up into the points. And he managed to completely outpace Gasly all weekend.
That's nice to see. Was that genuine, Chris, do you think?
I think so. Yuki's really turned a corner. And I think all the lessons that Red Bull and AlphaTauri were trying to beat into him almost last season, they're starting to take effect. And we're starting to see a fully utilized Yuki Tsunoda. And I will say that Gasly, I think he was carrying a little bit of damage after his incident with Stroll. So,
oh, wait a minute. What happened with Stroll?
There was an incident with Stroll.
Whose fault is it?
Whose fault was it? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and say Stroll. Any other counters to that? Jono.
Is that out of muscle memory, Spanish? Yeah, just saying Stroll's fault.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, send your emails to jono@australia.com.
I'm not going to comment on it. I can't be bothered on that midfield incident.
Oh. Wow, Kyle.
This one, I'm afraid to say, Spanners, I think it's pretty much 100% on Gasly. Gasly even admitted it at the end of the race. I don't know whether it was Stroll trying to overtake him or he was trying to, or he was defending, or whether he was trying to overtake Stroll, but it was a bit like the Verstappen and Russell into turn one around the outside. Stroll tried to go around the outside. There should have been space for him. Gasly understeered into him and clouted him. He's ended up with 2 points on his license and got a retrospective, or no, I think he got a 5-second penalty in race for it as well, which curtailed any chance of points. But I think Yuki had him beat then anyway. But it was clearly this time not Stroll's fault.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. Gen Z wants back in.
Well, no, I mean, I don't.
Oh, I meant
think...
Jono. You're not Gen Z. You're like a millennial, aren't you?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were... We're the same age, aren't
we? The same.
Oh, you're the same age. What? Oh my goodness! Right, watch the YouTube version, you audio listeners, and see why I got confused, Jono.
Oh, handsome blokes on the YouTube version. But look, has Bottas become Gasly last year or something? Like, what's going on? You know, Gasly, remember, used to be that best midfield driver, best of the rest, and Bottas is just sort of like. What the hell? What happened to Gasly? I don't remember this Gasly from last year. It might be the new car.
So I don't think the car is quite up to snuff yet. But on Bottas, right? The thing is, we all forget Bottas is a great racing driver. He just had the misfortune of being Lewis Hamilton's teammate for 5 or 6 years or however long it was. You're always going to look like a numpty next to Lewis Hamilton. So now that he's in an environment where he can excel, we are finally seeing the best of him. And that Alfa Romeo is a very good car as well. It must be said. It was great at the start of the season. They had a great upgrade package for Barcelona as well. And it's just firing on all cylinders at the moment.
Yeah, what a fantastic race from Bottas. He did the two stops, so he got absolutely rinsed at the end. Otherwise, he could have been fourth even. It was looking incredible. And yeah, we do forget. I think I've even said on this podcast that he's kind of damaged goods coming out of Mercedes, but it's still the same driver. You know, he's the same driver going in. He was a hotly, you know, when he's still in the Williams, everyone's like hotly tipped potential future world champion. It's just being Lewis Hamilton's teammate damaged his sort of stock, so to speak, but he's still an amazing driver. He was an amazing driver, but yeah, what an absolutely brilliant race from him. And again, he was all over his teammate. Joe struggled to get anywhere near him. And given the right strategy, Bottas could have been fourth today.
Every week, I sort of rank Alpha to be the fourth quickest car. Now, if it wasn't for Bottas, I feel like they'd be the seventh quickest car or whatever based on Zoe's performances. So Bottas has extracted so much potential out of that car. It's very, very impressive. Now, Chris, remember last year we talked about I wasn't a fan of Tsunoda because I said, look, I just thought it was bad, you know, last year to begin the year. But he sort of turned it around this year and I'm very impressed. Can Guan Yu Zoe do the same thing?
I think he can. I think he's been a little bit unlucky in the early stages. And of course, he's got so much to learn and to adapt to as well. This seemed like a bit of an off weekend, it must be said. But, you know, we're going to take each race as it comes. And I expect him to be on an upward trajectory.
All right. You're not going to like this, guys. Feedback at MissedApex.net. Spanners@MissedApex.net. You're not going to like this.
Here we go.
Also follow me at SpannersReady. You can follow Jono at what's your Twitter handle? It's terrible.
It's at JohnnyS8. And it's so bad. It's so bad, Spanners, that somebody's actually taken Johnny S. So I have to put the 8
JohnnyS8, okay. And at KylePowerF1 and at Chris on Racing. All our links to Twitter and stuff and to follow us and to subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/MissedApex. It's all in the show notes below, as is our email addresses, spanners@MissedApex.net. I think you guys are mad. As a lot of our chat room are pointing out, Russell is showing what you can do in the second Mercedes. Russell is showing what you can do against Lewis Hamilton if you're a legit top flight talent. Bottas was found wanting at Mercedes, was never able to establish himself as a number one. He is now being flattered by a rookie, borderline buy-in driver. He's got a great car underneath him and he's not maximising. I think you put 7 of the grid in that Alfa Romeo and they do better than Valtteri Bottas. Chris?
I think maybe George Russell is just the next Lewis Hamilton.
Wait, so you're saying he's like a generational talent and you can't expect
100%
Bottas?
100%
Yeah, but you're meant to... This is the pinnacle of motorsport. This isn't like the happy, clappy F1 rainbow unicorn dancey F1 club. This is the elite F1 motorsport. You can't get your shot at Mercedes and do what Bottas did and then be immediately shown up and still expect your reputation to survive.
Right, but the issue is those generational talents, there's only ever like two or three of them ever in Formula One at any one time. We've got 20 spaces on the grid. And that is just how good these people are. The rest of the grid are still sensational racing drivers.
I totally agree. Where I have the theory where I call them five-star drivers, who are your Schumachers, Hamiltons, your Russells, your Verstappens, those kind of guys. Now, your 4.5 stars are your Rosbergs, your Norrises, your that just step behind, that are really, really good and world championship material, but they're not that. Are you going to finish your career at top five all time? And Russell has the potential to do that if he finds the right car.
The sad thing is for me is a lifelong motorsport enthusiast and fan is if you made the F1 feeder series and the tier and the journey to F1 about driver talent and not about money, if you could somehow finance that pyramid of motorsport so that you looked at the kids that were doing grassroots karting and picked out the ones with the talent, every single driver on the grid would be Lewis Hamilton, Verstappen level or above. There shouldn't really be the room for your 4-star and your 3-star. This is the elite of motorsport. F1 should have 20 or 26, preferably, 5-star drivers on the grid.
Well, they've got 17. So okay. That'll...
I don't think so. I don't think they have. How many
five-star
drivers? Okay, quickly, before we go to the podium, how many 5-star drivers are there on this F1 grid? Hamilton, Verstappen,
yeah.
Leclerc. Okay, where are we going?
Leclerc? I thought Russell. You said he wasn't generational
he's
before.
He's unproven, but I'm just saying, at the moment, he seems like a 5-star driver. But where are the 5-star drivers on the grid?
Russell?
Yeah, there we go. That's four. It. Great.
Yeah, that is it. The rest of them are 4.5.
There you go. Then... So that's 4 out of 20. It's not great.
even Latifi?
No, I'm just kidding, guys. By the way. Let's move on to the podium. So at the end of the 2022 Spanish Grand Prix, my lasting feeling about the race is I had a very, very good time watching this Grand Prix and I wasn't expecting it. It was a surprise. And the new generation of cars, this new regulation series, is still under the watchful eye of the jury of whether they have achieved what they wanted to. I'm really optimistic that this generation of Formula One cars is on a path to creating better racing. Now, if you remember 2014, the start of the hybrid era, if you were basing the future of F1 on that season alone, you would have scrapped the hybrid concept and got rid of them forever. And I know some people still want to. But for 2022 to launch with these cars with specific aims in mind in the first season of a new philosophy of trying to create better racing, I think it is definitely in the zone where there's potential for success. If you can make a Spanish Grand Prix pop like that, I think there's a lot of potential yet in this sport and in this formula. Pirelli have got a big part to play, but also the people who planned this formula years out and planned this regulation change to look at how the aerodynamics work, to look at having cars being able to follow, to have Verstappen and Perez be able to stay on the back of George Russell and yet still have George Russell able to defend often against DRS. That mix is possibly some of the best F1 that I've seen in my fandom of watching Formula One. I think there's a lot to feel positive about. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I think there is a lot to feel optimistic about. So this is the part of the show where we give out some awards and we are sat in a shed and an office and a sofa. So who are we to really judge people? But we're going to do it anyway. But we start with the very positive award. And that is the thing of the weekend. So we get to start off being super positive, guys. Who would like to go first? Everyone wants to go first. Let's go with Jono from Australia at JonoS8 on Twitter. What's your thing?
Well, sort of.
Oh,
J-O-N-N-Y-E-S-S-8. Let's never speak of that until the next podcast.
Yeah.
So, my thing of the weekend, the pear-flavored Red Bulls. Number one, never heard of them before. And the fact that they exist for this very reason, to make fun of Aston Martin, is my thing of the week. Weekend.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Aston Martin rolled out with what looked like a Red Bull clone. So, a couple of things to come out of that. Firstly, you didn't clone it very well, because they were, where did they finish? Like 12th, 13th?
So Vettel was 11th, very close to the points. Oh, okay. But apparently this upgrade package has really compromised their cooling.
Oh,
what a terrible day to have that issue.
Yeah, on like one of the hottest races. So maybe we'll see better things out of this Aston Martin upgrade in more cooler climates. I mean, we're going to Canada in a couple of weeks where, I mean, there are polar bears in Canada, I think. I'm not a geography guy. However, they did prove to the FIA, to the FIA's satisfaction, that they hadn't copied Red Bull's design. And in fact, they were able to show that this concept had been in the wind tunnel in November. Therefore, Red Bull copied Aston Martin. There we go. It's true. Kyle, what was your thing of the weekend?
My thing of the weekend was, for the second year running, we had an exciting Barcelona Grand Prix.
Oh,
multiple stop races.
Yeah, because Barcelona for ages had that reputation of it's a procession, you're limited by the car, the cars would qualify in like team order, and it just hasn't been working out like that. And I think, you know, the credit has to go a little bit to the latest regulation change.
Hmm. Is this the new Hungary? Because Hungary was always a processional, boring race, and now the Hungarian Grand Prix tends to be extremely dramatic.
I'd say it was a Formula One issue at the time, because I remember there being a bunch of really great Spanish Grand Prix for quite a few years. And then it was when the turbo hybrid era started and Mercedes just turned into a dominant force that it didn't really pan out. But in the early stages of the Pirelli era, for example, cracking races.
Yeah, but if you look at those early F1 races that you're talking about, they look like micro machines compared to the beasts on track
But I wasn't around in 91 when it was built, so...
You weren't around? Exist. When were you born?
97.
What?
I know.
You were born in 1997?
Jacques Villeneuve was champion the year I was born.
Oh, man, I legit hate you.
No.
Jono.
I noticed today when I was watching the onboard shots, like the cars are so heavy, right? And it's like some people like that, and yeah, it can help the racing, but I think it looks ugly, disgusting. They look like Porsche Carreras out there. They don't look like Formula One cars anymore.
This is supposed to be the positive section of the show, Jono.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I'm very sorry. Very, very sorry.
I get to go first.
6:30 a.m.
All I know is that I get to go first for the negative one, because everyone's going to steal mine. Chris, what was your thing of the weekend?
My thing of the weekend is Haas's qualifying. Picture the scene. You're Mick Schumacher. You haven't made it into Q3 yet in your Formula One career. Your brake disc explodes in FP3. You get no running done at all. And your team has to do an incredible job to rebuild that corner of the car in time for qualifying. Big box ticked there. But then, oh no, Kevin Magnussen, his DRS isn't working all through qualifying. And yet they get both cars into Q3. What a job.
Yeah, well done, Haas. Where did they finish?
Right, now, let me defend this, okay? Because they found something with the floor. They suddenly were able to get loads of lap time out of it. It was working really well. And then they screwed it on strategy by leaving Mick out since lap 30 on the same set of tyres and then putting Magnussen on the hard tyres. What a terrible decision.
Yeah, they weren't strong and they were going backwards in the race, basically, Mick. I think even with good strategy, I don't think they would have got points. It seems like it was a qualifying car this weekend and not a race car.
Spanners, not to steal the segment and make it a Haas segment, but maybe they were the thing of the weekend. But the thing is, I remember we spoke about this earlier in our chat, and we were talking about how, well, does Haas have any development money? Because they're going to start the season off strong like they usually do. Is that car going to get better or worse over the course of the season? So that's another interesting topic for another day.
Well, I mean, Chris, you remember Force India were very much in that vein for years, weren't they?
Yeah, they didn't bring an upgrade to Barcelona. Their thing was just kind of a tweak in the setup. And the next one they're bringing isn't until Paul Ricard, like in July. So it's going to be a while until we see some significant progress being made with this car. But, you know, we've seen make one small tweak and suddenly the car comes alive. So, you know, they've still got good potential, I think.
I'm giving my thing of the weekend to George Russell for that defensive display. Like, you have to have some pace as well. You can't just park the bus at Barcelona like you can at Monaco. It took pace. It took ingenuity. It took tactical nous. And you have to go, can this guy actually race at the top level? And I think he's answered those questions. And yes, it was ultimately futile. You could have looked ahead in the race at the relative paces and gone, your battle with Perez, your battle with Verstappen is futile. You are better off actually just letting them go. The most sensible tactic would have been let those two go, run your own race. But he showed us that he is a fantastic racer. And like I said earlier, you know, my Russell fandom grew three sizes within my chest over this weekend. So he's my thing of the weekend. But now we get to be all super negative with this award.
Oh, no, you missed the apex.
It's the missed apex award. And I'm going to go first because I've got the feeling that everybody's got the same thought. So I'm so sorry. I know the coverage is innovative. I know they're trying new things with all the different camera angles and the helmet cam and stuff, but are they trying to make me feel sick? I felt like Loki. I felt like Loki in that Avengers scene where the Hulk is just smashing him into the ground time after time after time. It was helmet cam, shaky cam, drone camera, and then that was okay until it did a sudden bank and made me feel ill. And then they did a spinning pit cam. So you're watching a pit stop and the camera spins 360, Jono. And I was like, what are they trying to do to me?
All right, the drone is new, but they've done that spinning pit cam for like 10, 15 years. They have done that for a while, right? And it's very sickening. I've seen it for years. You know what? I was actually surprised when they did that because I'm like, they haven't done that since the Bernie Eccleston era of F1 TV.
Horrible. All of it was horrible. But, Chris, I do respect the trying new stuff. All of that stuff could be great, and I appreciate some things are pilots and do it in the practice sessions, get good at it. But every time that drone banked, I wanted to throw stuff at my TV.
Right, I'm furious because I put in the WhatsApp chat 2 days ago, I bagsy the drone.
I didn't see it. I just didn't see it.
What do you mean you didn't see it? You're looking at your own WhatsApp group. You made it.
Can't prove it.
Right, anyway.
Okay.
I agree. Let's innovate. Okay, but that experiment never should have seen the light of day. They should have taken one look at it and decided, we're not going to show this on telly this weekend because it was appalling. It was low quality. It was discolored. It was not stabilized. There was nothing on the screen. The cars were just a tiny little dot going across the screen. That is not coverage. And the fact that they went back to it so many times was just an awful decision.
They spent the money, hadn't
they? They need to work on it before bringing it back. Big time.
I fully agree. It was terrible. And I couldn't believe, I thought it was initially a mistake when they showed it in practice because the guy was just practicing. It was almost like one of the producer's kids has brought a drone.
And
Jimmy's bought a drone, let him put it up. And oh no, don't put it on the coverage. Oh, we've done it now. But as you said, they kept putting it on. And then during the race as well, it's like, oh, come on. Especially after we've seen Rallycross do it so well.
I know Rallycross did it well, but because you've like gone after like the individual that is doing the camera, there's probably different restrictions on this than the Rallycross. So, you know, Steve was telling me about drone restrictions over tracks and obviously the health and safety and the risk assessment and stuff. So this was probably like a first shot at doing it, a proof of concept. And so the drone pilot was flying to the brief. But like, I cannot handle my 50-inch TV suddenly banking.
That's nothing against the drone pilot itself.
Wait, it sounded very personal. That's all, Kyle.
The equipment seemed subpar. It was, yeah. Well, where did they get the drone from? Was it Argos? It didn't seem TV quality dronage.
Fair enough, Chris. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the coverage itself, I found fine. But the drone, it really needs to go away. It just didn't need to see the light of day.
What I wouldn't want them to do is feel pressured into not trying new stuff. I really appreciate the new stuff. Okay, so enough of that negativity. Let's move on. Chris, what's your mistake?
No, you need me. You need to come to me last.
Fine.
Okay. I don't know anymore.
Jono, what's your missed apex award?
Well, mine works out perfectly because it's TV related. And I don't think anyone said this all season. I don't think on any review podcast, but that back to front grid graphic Like, it's like, oh, welcome to Formula One for this race. Starting 20th. Ooh, Alonso starting 21st. Oh, no, wait, sorry, 19th. And like, sorry, but who counts down? What the hell? What's going on there? And it reminded me of, remember when Formula One used to count down the laps? So we're watching the race, right? You flick on the TV and you're like, oh, it's lap four of 60. Oh, no, wait, it's the end of the race. Yeah, yeah, oh, my yeah, God, yeah. I missed everything, you know?
Yeah, always go in chronological order. Yeah.
Ugh, terrible.
Kyle, terrible. What was your Missed Apex Award?
I have a couple. One of them has just flown out of my head annoyingly. But so I'll have to go to my reserve one, which was the rumours of terrible organisation on the circuits part.
Yeah, apparently.
People being
yeah.
left in queues for hours without water and passing out. So I did have a more humorous and light-hearted one than that, but I forgot it as soon as I went live. Down.
To follow that, by the way, go and follow Jenny Gao on Twitter. She's been tracking this spectator problem, and a lot of people apparently that paid for F1 fan experiences had been really messed around. So I think follow Jenny to see what happened there. Chris! What's your Missed Apex Award, Chris?
I can't even pick Haas's strategy because I already went in detail about it. So I will go for Alpine reliability. It is round six and Fernando Alonso is already taking engine penalties. That is concerning.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Guys, thank you so much for joining us for the Missed Apex Barcelona race review. Do follow my panel, Jonathan Simon. I always get that right. Did I get that right?
Yes, not Simone.
Yeah, not Simone, sorry.
Or Simone. Schneble.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever that one in School of Rock was.
Jonathan Simone. There we go. And follow Kyle Power, the most fragrant podcaster in F1 podcasting. And follow Chris at Chris on Racing. There will also be links to all the social media of the guys in the show notes below. And the ways to support us on Patreon and the ways to join us karting, and there will be some karting videos dropping early next week of our adventures at Ella Park.
Yeah, and we've already got the next one sort of lined up as well. And of course, next week will be the penultimate round of this season of the Missed Apex iRacing F3 Cup. So go to Missed Apex Motorsport on YouTube for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, look out on our Twitter. We will be promoting that. But next Friday, basically, will be most of the panel will be iRacing and it will be F3 at Barcelona. So see how the panel do in simulated single-seater Formula cars around the track that you've just seen really good people do it in real cars. I mean, I can't sell it any more than that, except that you've got Chris Stevens and Chris Catman-Turner on commentary. We've got great race coverage from Uncle Steve as well. So we can maybe nearly start to compare to the production. We've been all judgy about the F1 production. I promise, I guarantee our sim racing coverage is better. It's a bold claim, but you'll have to watch it to check it out. We'll be back with some kind of content, I think, on Tuesday. In fact, it is going to be a patron pod, which is our doom scrolling podcast, where we talk about F1, but we also divert and tangent and talk about our personal lives as well. So it's worse content as a reward for supporting us. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.